All right, we are going to get started. I think people are going to be trickling in today. Maybe not until the service starts, but people will be trickling in probably slowly. But let's get started. This is just for you guys to have and keep if you want. This is a lot of verses that speak to friendship and what it means to be a friend. Sometimes I think when we're doing something like a systematic theology, it's helpful to just have all the verses in front of you, especially because I'm just going to quickly reference a bunch of those. This is not every verse in the Bible that mentions a friend. If that were the case, we would have pages and pages and pages. This is kind of the more, I think, pertinent ones. But there's definitely more to it than that. So if you can, bring that with you each week as we're doing this. I think it'll be helpful to us to have those references. Certainly you can look these places up in the Bible, but especially when you're laying out a lesson, it's really helpful to just have them right there in front of you instead of having to flip back and remember what everything says. So, all right, so let me pray for us, and then we'll get going. Father, I thank you for this morning. I thank you for your gathered body, a gathered church. Thank you for the way that you have ordained this to be. And we pray that it would be a sweet blessing to each of us as we are here. I pray that, again, at this time in this class on the friendship would be beneficial and that you would increase and grow and deepen the friendships that we have here in this church. Pray this in your name. Amen. All right, so what we're going to do here to start is I want to ask you a few questions. And I'm going to write these answers on the board. So thinking about your past experiences in friendship, without mentioning names of people, hopefully, if you let it slip, that's fine. But try not to mention names, but simply just thinking about past experiences, here are some questions for us to answer. The first one is this. What have been key aspects of what made those friendships good? Like what has made your past friendships good? And preferably one word answers.
The gospel. Like centered around the gospel.
Gospel, centered.
Honesty.
Honesty.
Loyalty.
Loyalty.
Length
Trust.
Length of relationship.
Time, yeah, for sure.
Discretion.
Time, trust, discretion.
Being real.
What was that?
Being real.
Being together.
Time spent together.
Shared adversity.
I don't take notes in class. I'm really slow at it. Anything else? That's a good list.
Like selflessness.
Selflessness. Anything else?
Listening. Good listeners.
Good listening. Someone was going to say something else.
Just common interest.
No fear of man.
That's a lot of words, but I'll get it. All right, we ran out of room, so we'll have to stick with that. All right, next question. Maybe a little bit more personal. Again, you don't need to mention names. Some of you have probably lost friendships. Okay, what have been some factors in losing your friendships?
Sin.
Nice.
You're welcome.
End of list. That's pretty much it.
What else? Maybe a little bit more specific.
Selfishness.
Selfishness.
Mistrust.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of the opposite here.
Or broken trust, better than that.
Yeah.
Misunderstanding.
Yep.
Disagreement.
Those are long words.
You're doing good.
What else?
Moving away.
Distance. Anything else? I mean, I think that's a pretty good list.
Change, like one of us changing things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to put it into one word, but changing values. You can have friends that you really drift apart because your value systems have dramatically changed.
Yeah, I mean, if you are not a Christian, you become a Christian. A lot of your friendships are just going to change. Like, that's how it is.
Or even in Christianity, like, we value the same.
Yeah.
Talk about the guardrails. You can over there.
Yep. For sure. Even, I think, within this valley, we're used to changing of churches. We kind of lose friends when someone leaves our church. All of us only have so much capacity, right? And I think most of us value the relationships here in our church, and sometimes it's just hard to keep up with people outside of the church. All right, good. Okay, last question. And I took this question from a book on marriage, but I think obviously it applies to friendship. And you can't say sin. Sin is the overarching category for this. Okay. What are some barriers to deep oneness or deep friendship? What are some barriers?
Self-protection.
Time.
Pride.
What else? Bitterness.
Distance.
Jealousy.
That hurts.
Sometimes lack of vision or intentionality.
Yeah.
Superficialness.
Forgetfulness.
Stephen, what did you say?
Superficial.
I had to think about how to spell this. Superficial.
Supercalifragilistic.
Diana, what did you say then?
Forgetfulness.
Forgetfulness, for sure. Yeah.
Slow listening.
Yep. Yeah, and a lot of these obviously can transfer over. But yeah, I think all of this is a good list. These are all good lists as we're thinking about friendships. So then today, in the next few weeks, we're going to start getting into maybe some more of like the practical aspect of friendship, Christian friendship. Today specifically, we're going to look at six unique joys of friendship. So again, this is like, we're looking at the value of friendship, but consider this as we're thinking about practical things that we can do for friends and to enhance our friendships and to deepen our friendships. I think those things will fit. But one of the reasons I did this list is as we begin to talk about some of the practical day-to-day things of being a good friend and having these deep friendships, I think what we have to keep in mind is that for deep friendships, according to the Bible, according to Paul, we're to put on the fruit of the Spirit. Like, that's what's going to drive our friendships and the depth of our friendships. Paul's definition of love. Those are the basis for our friendships. So there's going to be a lot of tangibles that change. We all have different things going on in our lives. Those are all the tangibles. Some of us can make 6 a.m. breakfast work. Some of us can't. Some of us can have evenings free. Some of us don't. All of those things are tangibles. But these things are not going to change, and these things are always going to be barriers to friendship. That's just how it is. Some of these are tangibles a little bit, but most of these are heart things. So the answer then, and I know this is kind of vague and probably is going to frustrate some people just to say this, but the answer to growing in friendship is ultimately growing in the grace of God and the love of Christ. So the first and foremost thing you should be doing to become a better friend, just like the first and foremost thing you should be doing to become a better spouse or a better parent or a better pastor or a better employer or anything really, is to fervently pursue a relationship with the Lord. And often, it's not across the board, but often those things fall in line. When we're pursuing our relationship with the Lord, those things will fall in line. We've talked about this in marriage all the time, marriage counseling. Your first love is Christ, your second love is your spouse, right? So grow in your love for Christ, and in turn, that's going to transform the way that you love your spouse. And I think very similar things here for friendship. So just a short recap as we're moving on. I know that we've done this a lot. But we've seen now the need. That's what we've been trying to do the first 3 weeks, is to show the need for friendship from the Bible. And I think the need is expressed most clearly in Genesis 2:18, God saying, "It is not good for man to be alone." So aloneness in general. John talked last week about marriage filling that aloneness, right? But we can also just say in general, like, God just says it's not good for us to be alone. And we have to keep that in mind. Second base for our need is Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So the idea being that God is one in three persons, and therefore to reflect his image is also to have relationships. God is a relational being, and therefore we are created in his image to also be relational beings. And keep in mind that that image of God was what was declared pre-fall, right? Before God had to start kind of, this is a shallow word, but fixing his creation, he established that this is how man is to live, right? Pre-fall, in his perfection, it is not good for man to be alone. And then also, we haven't looked at this much at all, but post-redemption, redemption is a restoring of that image in us. And he creates us and he makes us. What does he do? He doesn't just he recreates us individually, but then he places us where?
In the church.
In the church, with a body, within relationships, right? So pre-fall, he says it's not good for man to be alone. Post-fall, he reestablishes kind of his image in us by putting us in a body of believers and saying, this is how you are to live, is to live within this body of people. I want to read page 48. Again, this is just a review, but he says, this highlights the uniqueness of the true God. If Allah created Adam, then Genesis could just as well have read, Adam was alone, and Allah saw that it was very good. Why? Because Allah is solitary. A solitary Adam could reflect that image perfectly well. Selfless love could never be one of Allah's essential qualities, for there has not always been another person to love.
but God is love, because God is triune. There is never a time when love was not, because there is never a time when the Trinity was not. To be made in God's image, the God who is love, means that we, at the creaturely level, are wired for relationships. God made us to enjoy him and reflect him, and a beautiful implication is that we were made to enjoy a life of communal love. That's helpful for us to remember that our need comes from us being created in the image of God, who is Trinity. All right. Any comments or questions on that before we move on? All right. So, as we're moving on to the practical things, I said this already. We're not all the same. So in the practical nature of friendship, then, there's not a one-size-fits-all for us. This doesn't, what I do with my friends is not going to necessarily work for the next person and what they do with their friends. So I'll ask you this. What are some challenges for extroverts in friendship? That seems like an odd question to ask, right? But what are some challenges for extroverts? Did you say one, Don?
Yeah,
for them to be quiet, yeah.
I'm just getting stretched too.
He's not saying that in an offense to anybody in here. Good.
Well, I think getting stretched too thin, because it's easy to make connections, just one after another, after another, after another. So
yeah.
You don't end up with the depth.
Yeah. Yeah, superficiality. Yeah, we could say you have many companions, but not a lot of close friends. Okay? What are some challenges for introverts?
Isolation.
Isolation, for sure.
Maybe it's introspection that causes the isolation.
Yeah, a lot of times introverts are introspective as well.
Maybe take a long time to move anywhere.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time to probably deepen some friendship. And again, we have to keep in mind, introverts doesn't mean you don't like people, right? Introverts just means how you recharge is alone, okay? I think probably a lot of us here would say we're introverts, but we still like people, hopefully. I know this is a funny illustration, but he says this about introverts, thinking, some batteries that are perpetually plugged into the wall, what happens to them? They lose their capacity, right? And so when we're introverted and we just constantly just say, oh, I'm introverted, I don't need friends or whatever, and we remain kind of plugged into the wall, we begin to lose our ability then even to make friends. So the danger for an introvert would be to use the excuse of introvertedness to deny the need. Okay, what are, then even getting more practical, what are some challenges for single people, and what are some challenges for married people, people that have kids? So thinking about all of those people, like that's what makes up a church, what are some challenges to friendships within all of those different relationships? Single people versus married people, or elderly people, or young people, what are some of the practical challenges in friendship?
Time.
I think we all understand, but explain.
Well, if you live in a family, you already have people to serve and to build those relationships, so that's really challenging, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure.
I think from a single person's perspective with what Diana was saying, they might feel like they're imposing on a married couple because they're like, oh, they're too busy, I don't want to take away from their time, you know, so that would make them hesitate to get together.
Yeah. What else?
Seems like sometimes in the context of a marriage too, like it's ideal if you can have friends that are married, and so if there are couples where one spouse is a really good fit in friendship and the other is not, then that's a complicating factor.
Yeah, for sure. Anything else?
Interests.
Yeah, interests. Common interests. And I mean, we all know how it is. Parents are often, like, all they can do, their only category to think anymore is their kids, right? and it's hard then to relate to someone else when your whole life experience at the time revolves around what's going on with your kids.
I would say assumptions too, like the singles might look at those families and think they're not going to really want me around, and then the married families might assume that the single's not going to really want to hang around, you know, like that with that interaction, like they're, you know, there's that kind of that assumption that that their life is too boring for the singles, and the singles think that they're too busy for them.
So. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the idea here is just to recognize again. Time, capacity, kids, marriage, location, things go on and on that list. All of those things can change and we can remain in friendships, but the idea is what can't change is our growing in Christ and our growing in the fruit of the Spirit, and that's how we maintain our friendships. If we're growing in the fruit of the Spirit, we become more selfless, right? And therefore can make sacrifices for friends that we were not willing to make in the past. Right? If you think about, say, two men in the church, past 5 years, have been getting together every Tuesday morning for breakfast. This started because they both decided they wanted to grow in their marriages. Right? And after 3 months of that, they decided, let's just keep doing this because this is really helpful for us. And they love it. They've grown in friendship together. And then one morning at breakfast, the one man says, "Hey, I got a promotion at work, and now all of these things are changing about my life. I'm going to start to make more money, but I'll have more time with my family. I'll have better hours, et cetera, et cetera." And says, "I can't meet on Tuesday mornings anymore, right?" And if this is a change in like practical things, right? No longer can you meet on Tuesday mornings. So a selfless person is going to say, "Great, how about Saturday morning?" Or, I value this friendship so much. I recognize that I need this friendship so much. And we're going to show some selflessness. Just a deep sense of love, right? And we can change the practical things as we continue to grow in the fruit of the Spirit or in what God says is what love is in 1 Corinthians 13, right? Yeah, John.
I think even with that example, I've seen success like divide friendships. So two people are equal for years and years and years, and then God blesses one of them with an extraordinary success that the other one doesn't have. And sometimes it's the person that feels, you know, left behind that pulls away, and sometimes it's the other person. But I think that's a big challenge too. And it's really beautiful when those friendships actually stay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and things like that, or even like adversity, right? In all of our friendships, there's always minor offenses that we have to look over. And sometimes there's major offenses as well. And if we're not growing in the fruit of the Spirit, we're going to just let selfishness, bitterness, jealousy, pride, all of those things get in the way of allowing those friendships to grow, right? Good. So sum all this section up. Putting on Christ is the basis for a good friendship, right? Look at Christ. Everybody wanted to be around him. I mean, obviously, he performed miracles and everything like that, but he was a good person to be around. People, his disciples enjoyed being around him, right? Because he was Christ. He's not putting on Christ. But, he lived with the fruit of the Spirit. All right, C.S. Lewis says, "Friendship is the greatest of worldly goods. Certainly to me, it is the chief happiness of life." So what we're going to do is take the rest of the time here to look at six unique joys of real friendship. And again, keep these things in mind. Keep like practical things in mind as we're going through that. So the first unique joy of friendship is it doubles our joys. Okay? It's going to be a an argument a little bit from just like how we live in general and how we can observe how the world works. But it's true. Friends simply add happiness to our lives. That's just what friends do. If you think about the greatest joys in your life, usually it is experiences that involve other people. And we could put family in here. I'm not denying that we couldn't have our best friend to be our sibling or whatever. Those are good things. But the greatest joys in our lives usually are shared experiences with other people. The flip side of this is some of the most painful moments of our lives, and I want to recognize this. Some of you are probably like, well, yeah, I used to have a lot of happiness with other people, and now that's brought about a bunch of sadness, right? I understand that that is the flip side of these things. Job, like, think about Job. This is what he understood. Job 19:14. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. Job 19:19. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I loved have turned against me. Job 19:21. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O God. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. So Job experienced the opposite of that, right? Where his friends who came by his side didn't bring joy and happiness to him. They just brought more sorrow and more despair. So we have to recognize that. But Hunter talks about friendship as, I think this is helpful language, as an inaugurated eschatology. All right. Oh, shoot, I put the wrong page. I might take that back. I take that back. He did say that it's an inaugurated eschatology, as in, like, we're looking forward to the end, right? Where what are we going to be doing? We're going to be worshiping God, but with all of the saints, right? So true friendship, the happiness that we get in this life from friends, is an inaugurated eschatology as we look forward to the future. And then think about naturally, what does a kid do when they do something really cool? What's the first thing that they do usually? If they've done something really cool by themselves, what do they do?
Mommy, Daddy.
Yeah, they want to come and share that experience with their parents, right? How do adults do that in maybe a little bit more of a sophisticated way? They tell their friends. Like, when you come into, maybe, I don't know if women have this experience, but you come into work the next day, and you're like, did you watch the game last night, right? You want to share that experience with your friend. You're hoping that they say yes, and if they say no, then it's kind of a bummer. But you're hoping that they say yes, because then you can talk about the game and, like, in a sense, enjoy it together. Relive some of the moments of that game or whatever it is. So this is how we act all the time. What? Give me a personal example of this from someone's life. What's an experience that you've had that you know your friendship and the people that were with you made that experience what it is? Maybe you've even tried to go recreate the experience without the friend, and you realize how disappointing it is. Anybody have an example?
Sharing pictures of a good vacation or a new baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, telling the person about it.
Yeah, for sure. Good. Awesome. All right, number two. Unique joys of friendship is friends have our sorrows. Now, this is cheesy imagery, but I think this is helpful. He says, we all walk through seasons of darkness, and when we do, a close friend is like a sun's ray that pierces through the clouds to give a shaft of warm light. Proverbs 17:17, a friend loves at all times. A brother is born for adversity. Proverbs 18:1, whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment. All right, so there's two ways specifically that friends can have our sorrows. First one is they encourage us with their presence. Luther wrote this, who a lot of our perceptions of Luther is that there's no chance in the world that he had any friends with some of the things that he said. But he did. He said, solitude produces melancholy. When we are alone, the worst and saddest things come to mind. We interpret everything in the worst light. Okay, so no need to raise your hands on this, but I wonder if any of you have had the experience of being in a discouraged or a despairing mood, and that you've allowed that to guide your decisions about what you're going to do, as far as if you're going to go spend time with people or if you're just going to go and loathe kind of on your own, right? That's all of our experience. We battle that, I think, all the time. I'm not talking about someone that's just discouraged from being too busy. That's a different thing. Some people do just need a night at home, and that's okay. But simply having a bad day and then choosing to isolate yourself, I would argue those are the times that we need a friend the most. Because oftentimes, what do we do when we're in that despairing moment and we don't have someone to be with us? We isolate ourselves and then we start to get in our own heads. Everything, we kind of look at life with the glasses half empty, right? We despair. At the end of this series on friendship, I'm going to take a class just to look at the friendship of William Cooper and John Newton. I know I've mentioned them a bunch of times. Cooper, it's spelled Cowper if you go to look him up. Cooper wrote, "There is a fountain filled with blood," and a lot of other hymns and poems. But what's basically best known about him is that he lived a life of depression. John Newton was his pastor and a friend. And John Newton did this for Cooper. It's remarkable when you read a biography. So he invited him to take long walks with him as he visited the homes of the parishioners. So John Newton, part of his job was to go and visit people in his church. And he's like, instead of you just despairing at home, just come alongside me and walk with me and do these things with me. Newton sacrificed vacation one time in order to not leave Cooper alone. And then Newton also invited Cooper to live with him for a year. Like, that's true friendship, right? He recognizes Cooper was probably going to take his life. And there's a lot of evidence from that as you read some of his writings and stuff. And Newton realized that a good friend is going to spend time with his friend and encourage him. And it wasn't just a one-sided relationship. So Newton writes this about their relationship. It says, "The Lord who had brought us together had so knit our hearts and affections that for nearly 12 years we were seldom separated for 12 hours at a time when we were awake and at home. The first six I passed in daily admiring and trying to imitate him." That's Newton trying to imitate Cooper. "During the second six, I walked pensively with him in the valley of the shadow of death." That's what we're talking about. Friends have our sorrows just by their presence. Second thing would be friends ease our sorrows through encouraging words. Proverbs 18:4, "A man's spirit will endure sickness, but a crushed spirit who can bear?" Meaning the writer of the Proverbs is saying depression is significantly worse than bodily sickness, right? And I'd imagine that any of you that have experienced some of that depression would agree with that, right? The feelings of depression and deep anxiety are far worse than having the stomach bug. You can't get out of it, right? But then Proverbs 12:25 says, "Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad." A good word makes him glad. He makes this argument in the book, but I think this is a great argument to make, that a central purpose of friendship is the ministry of encouragement or good words. Right? A good word makes him glad. So when someone is stuck in their own head, often a good word of promise and encouragement from God can really help. Not promise and encouragement from yourself, but point them to God. I often, a really helpful image for me, even as I'm preaching, is my goal is to point people past myself to, not the screen that's right behind me, but the cross that's right behind me, technically, right? And so think about that. As we're trying to build friendships, the goal is to not necessarily comfort your friend with promises from yourself, but your goal is to comfort your friend with promises from God, right? That's where we're going to derive the most comfort from. Again, I know I've mentioned this already, but you can't get enough of Pilgrim's Progress. I honestly would say this. I say a lot of things are the best book in the world, but I think second to the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress is the best book that's ever been written. But if you're familiar with this story, Christian and Hopeful, they're captured by Giant Despair, who locks them in a dungeon. This all sounds really weird if you haven't read the book. Giant Despair catches them, puts them in a dungeon. Giant Despair is making multiple attempts at basically getting Christian and Hopeful to commit suicide. That's his goal. He's just causing them to despair more and more so that they would commit suicide. And it's actually working for Christian. Like, Christian is convinced of this, right? And then all throughout their interactions, Hopeful is the word, the good word, that's saying, no, don't despair. No, don't despair. We're gonna make it to the celestial city. We're going to get out of it. He's encouraging him with words of the gospel. And eventually, through those good words, what happens is Christian remembers that he had been given the key of promise. Again, this all sounds really odd. But he's been given this key of promise, and it unlocks the gates to get them out of Giant Despair's grips. Okay? That's the idea. A good word helps us as friends move past our despair. And sometimes it's a good word over and over and over and over again. And then when the next week starts, it's doing the same thing over and over and over again. I got the page right on this one. He says on page 68, here's Bunyan's great insight. Bunyan wrote Pilgrim's Progress. Sometimes we need a friend to help us turn the key. Why? Because God brings us hope through his word, and his word is external to us. We need to hear God's promises. The ideas swirling in our minds often seem hopeless. Even when we recall God's promises in our minds, we often do little more than weakly slip the key into the keyhole. We don't yet have the strength to turn it. But when a friend speaks these promises, when a friend brings this external word to our ears, we gain strength to turn the key. It is as though our friend grabs the key with us and helps us to turn it. So I think an encouraging word for us all in that is, when we are in despair, right? Isolation is not the answer to our despair, right? A good friend is the answer to our despair. And I think that's helpful for us as married couples. That's helpful for us as friends. When your friend admits despair to you, go and spend time with them, a lot of time with them, as much time as you can give. Take the steps that Newton took with Cooper, and just continue to pour good word after good word to your friend. Similar, the unique joy of real friendship, number three, is counsel from the heart. So this is very similar to the last one. Proverbs 17:9, oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. So this earnest counsel means counsel of soul, or counsel from the heart. And the counsel of soul comes from two things in particular. First one is personal knowledge. So a good friend knows us better than anyone else. Sometimes we could even say that a good friend knows us better than ourselves, right? They've seen our joys and our sorrows. They know what you think and what you value. They have seen how you respond to conflict and how we handle suffering. You have a long history, usually, that gives insight that, and not, this isn't to deny professional counseling, but a good friend has profound insight into your life that a professional counselor will never have. Okay? Again, I'm not saying there's no need for professional counseling, but it's going to be better if it can be a good friend that's going to give you counsel. So personal knowledge and proven love. A good friend loves us more than any author or professional counselor is going to love us. Friends have a vested interest in you. They feel your problems in a way, in way different capacity than others do. All right, so personal knowledge and a proven love. One, maybe one encouragement and one practical application from this is maybe not even necessarily thinking about like counsel as in I'm living in sin and I need counsel and help to get out of it, but just counsel in life in general, making decisions. I'd really challenge us as a church, this is how we build friendship, as a church, go to your friends or go to people in the church and seek counsel from them, even on a major decision in your life, even on some minor decisions. Right? So when a wife and a husband disagree, bring a friend into that and allow them to help you work through those things. If you're thinking about changing a job, it should not be, in a sense, a surprise to your friends when you announce that job change. Those conversations should have already been happening, right? And then they kind of know where you're headed. Buying a house, having kids, marriage, all of these things. I'd encourage you and challenge us to really invite friends in on those decisions. I think it shows that you trust them, and they probably in turn will show some trust to you, right? And I think that's just how we are called to live as a body of believers. Anybody that's willing to share, again, you can try and leave out names here. Anybody that's willing to share that you've had that experience, where either a friend comes and asks you, and you that, not that we're like trying to do things to get, but someone's come and asked you for advice, and that has caused your heart to be warmed to that person, or vice versa. You've gone to someone, and they've given you good counsel, and it was really helpful and encouraging. Any experiences, personal experience?
Yes.
You didn't share any.
So, for a good example, because he's not here, I can talk about him. A good example was C.J. Miller when they were trying to make some decisions about taking this role in Louisville and kind of expanding a team and whatever. We had a really good series of conversations about that and then just making that decision to take it on and to go.
Yeah.
And to sell their house and do all that good stuff. So
yeah.
it did strengthen our friendship to walk through that together.
For sure. Good. Anything else?
I can think of one example that kind of goes with multiple things that you've said, but we have a daughter who is struggling in a variety of different areas that we've sought advice from other friends, like Melissa is meeting regularly, and we've visited a lot with Nick and Jen about some of these struggles, and it's just sort of like an ongoing challenge, like with any challenges with kids. And this last week we went on a date with Nick and Jen, and I just realized along the way in the conversation that I mentioned to them, like, she's not as defiant about all of these little instructions as she usually is. And I just said it sort of like, I just noticed it. And Jen was like, that's so exciting. Like, that's a huge deal. And it wasn't until she said how exciting it was that I realized how exciting it was that my daughter was making that progress. And so, and I haven't got to tell Melissa that yet. So there we go.
But perfect. It's just like, we just know a lot of things in one.
It's just really cool to be able to, like, other people are sharing that struggle and the joys of success in growth in a child.
Yeah. So that's a really helpful example. Good. All right. Unique joy of friendship. Number four. We change the world through friendship. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12. And I know I've read all these passages in the past. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So, in a sense, we can change the world, right, through friendships. There's examples from Scripture abound in this area. Adam and Eve, Moses and Aaron, Jesus sending out his disciples, not alone, but in twos, right? He sends them out in pairs. The apostles working together. Even we can take this isn't necessarily
speaking directly about friendship, but just how life works. We believe strongly that God has ordained a plurality of elders to run a church, not just one man, right? Church discipline. When you bring two people together, it can be more effective. And then, obviously, the greatest example of this is God saved us to be a part of a church, right? This is all throughout the Bible. He's saying this. You can change the world, and I think we understand what that means, right? God changes the world. But he uses people usually in friendships and working together to do those things. This is obviously an example from culture, but the Lord of the Rings is a fantastic example of this. Frodo and Sam, right? Frodo wants to go and take the ring alone, right? And Sam goes and almost drowns himself, right, to catch up. I've only seen the movie, so maybe that doesn't happen in the book. But that's a confession. You guys are all looking at me like, that doesn't happen. So Sam... No, I haven't. Because they made it into a movie. No, I have actually read that one. but it's that idea, right? Frodo's not going to take the ring alone to destroy it. And even probably a lesser-known story about that, some of you probably know that Tolkien and Lewis were good friends. Tolkien says this about Lewis. He said that it was only C.S. Lewis' steady encouragement that kept him writing. Perhaps this is why the theme of friendship stands out so prominently in the story. In Tolkien's day, authors only produced fairy stories, as they were called, for children, not adults. But Tolkien wrote for adults, too. He eventually wrote The Lord of the Rings, but it was only because of his relationship with Lewis. 2 years after Lewis died, Tolkien reflected on Lewis's role in his life. The unpayable debt that I owe to him was not influence, as it is ordinarily understood, but sheer encouragement. He was, for long, my only audience. Only from him did I ever get the idea that my stuff could be more than a private hobby. But for his interest and unceasing eagerness for more, I should never have brought The Lord of the Rings to a conclusion. So again, we, in a sense, change the world through friendship. Number five, we make friends and then friends make us. So first, our friends shape us. They have the ability to bring out different parts of our character, and different friends obviously do this in different ways. When someone loses a friend or a spouse, what do people often say? I've lost a part of me, right? When we lose someone to death, or even lose someone to some of these things, right? We've lost a part of ourselves. And then second, and Proverbs speaks to this, our friends influence the moral direction of our lives. Proverbs 13:20, whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Proverbs 22:24-25, make no friendship with a man given to anger, nor go with a wrathful man, lest you learn his ways and entangle yourself in a snare. Okay? So we're influenced by our friends, for good or for bad. And that happens, right? Because we become what we love, right? That's how the Bible speaks to us. We increasingly love what our friends love. We become that type of person. Another way this works in that friends shape us is friendship is really a school of virtue, right? We can't put on all of these things without another person. Loyalty doesn't work, right? I mean, you can be loyal to yourself, I suppose, but you're not going to grow in loyalty because we're all loyal to ourselves in a sense, right? So friends help us put on self-sacrifice. Friends help us put on self-denial. Amanda and I have been convicted a bunch of times by the ways friends have sacrificed for us. And we see that, and it encourages us, it drives us to do the same for others, right? So friends shape us. The last point is friends make friends less weird.
A.C. Grayling says, if you think of someone who has no friends, you see what can happen. A human being like a neglected garden may become rather overgrown, quite literally dirty and unkept, unsocial, introverted. This is pretty harsh. Sorry. After a bit, eccentric or half-mad. Social intercourse keeps people quite literally clean and reasonably polite, sane and functional. Okay, so that's not to say that we shouldn't overlook quirks of our friends, right? I think that's a part of friendship. But we all have to realize that also a part of a friendship is that we help one another, he uses the word weird, grow less weird. Henry Ward Beecher says, every man should keep a fair-sized cemetery in which to bury the faults of his friends. Okay. So we should bury the faults of our friends, but we also should help our friends grow in becoming more social. Okay? That's all I have. Any quick comments or questions? We have to break, but... All right. Bruce is going to teach next week. I'll be in Pennsylvania. And then I'll be back for the following week. Let me pray. Father, thank you for this morning. I thank you for friendships. And I pray that we would grow in our friendships, God, especially this morning as we go to sit under your word being sung and being preached. God, I pray that we would all take advantage of that and begin to talk about those things with one another. Pray for your help this morning as we worship in your name. Amen.